Well, good morning, all of you. It's a happy St. Patrick's Day to each of you. A little fair warning, I don't think I'm going to talk about St. Patrick's Day at all or St. Patrick, so I'll leave that to your lunchtime conversation. But thank you, St. Patrick. So we are now coming into this home stretch of Lent, of our Lenten journey. It has always felt like a season to me of it's a challenging season in a lot of ways. I always feel like God gives you challenges during the Lenten season. For instance, he gave me a baby this Lent. But we're almost to our end. And I do think for many of us, it is a season where at the end of it, we can feel maybe a tinge of dissatisfaction or maybe disappointment. I know if you've tried to give something up or maybe you've taken something up, sometimes you can feel disappointed in yourself for not achieving whatever it is you set out to do, or maybe the practice that you've endeavored to undertake hasn't quite produced the results you desired in your own soul. And so it's understandable sometimes at the end of Lent to feel a little bit disappointed. I have before, for sure. And so I think at the end, it is a good time to remember what the primary goal is, which is not the perfection of our practices. It's not 100% execution of what you set out to do, but it's the renewal of your heart. It's the formation of our souls. It's the rebuilding of our own interior life into the posture of Jesus Christ toward God. The goal is that God would give us a new heart. That's the goal. And our reading from Jeremiah, it says all of this. In fact, it promises all of this. If you caught that, Jeremiah 31, it's one of the more hopeful passages in Jeremiah, a book with not very many hopeful passages. But God tells this prophet, he says, I will put my law in their heart. I will be their God. They will be my people. They will all know me. No one will ask their neighbor about me, about who God is, because they will all know me from the inside out. They will know me sufficiently and wholeheartedly, completely. It's as if Jeremiah here is describing a condition where there's no half-hearted obedience or sort of strained adherence to a particular standard. He even goes as far to say that this covenant will not be like the covenant that he made formerly, in which the Israelites tried to perform but then broke. This new covenant will be a totally new way of living and being. It will involve a condition of absolute surrender and transformation from the inside of our being to the outside of our habits and actions. Ezekiel 36 reiterates, it doubles down on what Jeremiah has said. It says not simply that God's people will receive a law written on their hearts. He says they will receive a new heart entirely, a heart with a disposition of absolute devotion and commitment and adoration, which involves all of our emotional faculties, our souls, even our minds and our bodies. Even our liturgy asks for something like this. We pray for this every single Sunday. Maybe you are thinking of this in our post-communion prayer, which we'll pray in just a few minutes. We ask that God would enable us to love and serve him with what? Gladness and singleness of heart. Singleness of heart. Can you imagine what it would be like to have a heart that longs and does and seeks out one thing? Even if we don't realize it, I think most of us long for a heart like this, a way of being that has integrity and direction and consistency and purpose. Furthermore, just compare that for one moment with the sort of disintegration that we see in the world around us. One of my theological mentors wrote an essay once, and he describes our own way of being as individualized, grasping, superficially attuned to our being, unstable and unaware, drifting, and articulately anxious. I've certainly felt all of those things. And so when God tells Ezekiel that he will give his people a new heart, or Jeremiah that he will give them a heart of flesh with the law written upon it, we have a promise, friends. a promise for something better than our hearts being torn into all the sundry pieces and directions that our world has to offer. So strange is it that I wonder even what that might look like. What would it look like to have a heart with God's law written on it that longs for one thing? Well, our gospel reading does give us two clues, at least, I think. And the first one is harder to catch than the second. Did you notice in our gospel reading at the beginning, it details that all of the Jewish people are coming to Jerusalem for the Passover festival? It's the greatest holiday of the Jewish season. There are all throngs of them coming into the city to commit their lives to the Jewish practices of the Passover. But in our reading, it says that it is not just the Jews who have showed up. In that first verse, you'll notice it says that there were some of them at the festival who were Greeks. Greek here is simply code for not Jewish. Why would the text mention this? Why would it mention this? Because these Greeks would know nothing of Jewish law. They would know nothing of the Passover. They would know nothing of the tribes. They would know nothing of the promises. They would know nothing about the prophets. They would know nothing about the prophecies of the Torah. And yet here, isn't it remarkable? They show up and they come to the Apostle Philip and they say to him, "Sir, we wish to see Jesus." Or even more accurately, "Sir, we desire to see Jesus." These are a people who have completely different gods, totally different rituals. They are the wrong ethnicity. They're from the wrong nation. And here they come and announce to the apostles of Jesus Christ that they long to see Jesus. What on earth is going on? What does this mean? Well, I think it simply means that their hearts, their interior disposition, the emotional seat of their person, their hearts are being changed. Their desires are being suddenly renewed. Their delights, the things that cause them to make actions, are being made different. Not their heads, not their volitional, interior, intellectual habits, but the things that they long for. In other words, the law, the character of God, is being made evident, manifest to all people. And so the prophecy given in Jeremiah slowly begins to come true when these Greeks ask that they might see Jesus. It is like the sun coming up over the horizon. Their hearts are being renewed when their minds might be telling them something entirely different. And isn't this, in some ways, what it's like to see someone become a Christian? I don't know if you've been around somebody who's recently become a Christian. It's the most amazing thing. It's like being around someone who is renewed. Their desires are made new. Their commitments are fresh. Their delights are suddenly brighter. The direction of their life sometimes changes, but not out of an intellectual commitment, out of something that happens within their soul. The way I think about it is, this is the wrong season to use this quote, but there's this famous T.S. Eliot poem that he writes about the Magi and their journey to go see Jesus. Remember, the Magi were Persian astrologers of some sort. They were not Jewish people. They knew nothing about the scriptures as well. And yet they show up for Jesus' birth. T.S. Eliot concludes the poem that he writes of their journey like this. He says, "We returned to our places, these kingdoms, but no longer at ease here in the old dispensation, with an alien people clutching their gods." No longer at ease here in this old dispensation, surrounded by people, alien people, clutching their little g gods. To become a Christian is to have your heart renewed, made fresh, soft. And that's what we see, friends, that happens with the Greeks. So that's the first thing. The second thing is this. The second image we get of what it might look like to have a heart that is made soft toward the will of God, one that is singular in its devotion, is Jesus himself. Look at what the text says They ask to see Jesus. Philip tells Andrew. Andrew and Philip then go tell Jesus. Jesus does not say, bring him to me. He doesn't say, introduce me via email. He says the hour has come. For what? For the Son of Man to be glorified. In other words, the prophecy is beginning to be fulfilled. The manifestation of God's law in the person of Jesus Christ is revealed to all people, to Gentiles and to Jews. And so now it is time for his singular purpose to come. It is time for him to turn to the cross. And he even mentions all of this. He says that it is his time. He says that he desires to do it, that he wants to do it. In other words, the decision to go to the cross for Jesus, it is easy to think of it as a brute obedience, a sort of escalator of his personal movement up onto the cross, maybe one of those moving sidewalks in an airport. But that couldn't be further from the truth. Jesus's will, his heart, is to do that which his Father asks him. And he says that it is his glory to do it. What that means is when Jesus' arms go onto the hardwood of the cross, it is not that those soldiers are wrestling him onto it, but that he lets them do it. Jesus' will is preserved the entire way through. He wills one thing, which is the atoning work of bringing sinners into the life of God. In other words, friends, Jesus longs. His heart is given over to the will of God the Father. But there's one last aspect of this prophecy, one last image that I think we have to see in order to fully understand this. The heart that God promises to give his people, the one of flesh with the law written upon it, it is God's own heart. You see, when we say in the creeds that Jesus is the only Son of God, it is not just some divine coincidence that God only has one Son. It is not an accident. The reason God has one Son is because Jesus Christ is the singular expression of God's person, his character, and his work. Jesus is the Son of God because he is God's own very heart. He is all of himself. There's a contemporary hymn that I love. It begins like this. It says, goodness gracious, I didn't write it down. It's a problem when you riff off the text. It says, if you ever find yourself up here, write it down. It says, what gift of grace is Jesus my Redeemer? There is no more for heaven now to give. There is no more for heaven now to give. That is why Jesus is the only Son of God, because there is nothing left in heaven. God has exhausted his giftedness, his own person, in Jesus Christ, which means, friends, that Jesus is God's own heart. And like anyone who gives away their heart, it means they risk losing everything. You see, not only does God give us what is most precious to him, but he places that gift into fallible hands. C.S. Lewis once famously wrote that to love at all is to be vulnerable. He says, love anything and your heart will be wrung and possibly broken. If you want to make sure of keeping your heart intact, you must never give it to anyone, because to love is to be vulnerable. God the Father, in giving God the Son, gives us his own heart, and guess what, friends? We break it. God gives us his own heart, knowing that we will break it. So what does this mean for us? What does it mean to have a new heart with God's law written onto it? Why would God give his own heart in the first place? It means, friends, that by knowing God, by receiving his very heart, by spending time in his person given to us, our own hearts can be transfigured, made whole, directed, at rest. It means no more grasping, No more superficial relation to our own being. No more instability and unaware drifting. No more inarticulate anxiety about who we are and what we're for. You see, to be a Christian, to be recipients of God's own heart, it is not to be something different in this world necessarily. It is simply to know what a human being is for and to rest in the gift of Jesus. It is to know God and to have our hearts compelled by his magnificence, his grace, his power, his goodness. It is to be transformed from the inside out. And that is why we are given God the Son, to see and to know and to hold the heart of God, that our hearts might be renewed, transfigured indirectly. You know what it looks like most? We know what it looks like in Jesus Christ, but what does it look like for us? It looks like the gift of the martyrs. Tertullian, an early saint, An early saint of the church, he once wrote, it's a famous quote, he says, "The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church." The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. Why? Because their witness of complete devotion, absolute willing surrender to the calling of God reveals how God transfigures, transforms, illuminates our own hearts in a world that is broken. It reveals what it looks like to have God's heart come dwell in your own and to be directed by his own purposes. That's why the martyrs are the seed of the church. Recently, my mom and dad went to Milan with my brother. My parents are now in that stage of life when they'll send me a text one week and it will say things like, "We're going to Milan next week with your brother." I'm not jealous at all. It's all right. He's like 30 years older than me. And he looks it. Just kidding. But in Milan, they went to Ambrose's tomb. Have any of y'all been to Milan? You can go to Ambrose's tomb. It's a whole shrine. There's an entire church built around it. But when you walk down into the crypt, it's incredible. You can look. I've actually been there myself, so I'm not that jealous. You can look into the window, and you can see Ambrose's his body. His remains are all there. And so my mom crept up close. She took this image of Ambrose laying there, and she sent it to me. I woke up, and I got it in the morning, and I looked at it. If you look at the image of Ambrose, it is remarkable. He is a corpse, but his dignity is preserved to an uncanny degree. He looks noble and resolute. He looks like a king, like one who had purpose and was driven, who had a sort of manifold glory in the world. And if you read about him, he was the prince of the pulpit. He was one of the greatest preachers of the early church, probably the church period. He could compel masses with his words. So excellent at preaching was he that he even converted Saint Augustine himself with his teaching. This man was formidable, and he looks it. And yet, if you look closely at the image of the crypt, you'll notice that there are two people beside him. These two men, I've looked it up, they are basically nobodies. They are unimportant. In fact, nobody is really sure what they even did. They were probably farmers from Gaul or northern Italy. No one really knows. But the story is they were martyred under either Nero or Diocletian. We don't know which one. And Ambrose heard about them. And he said, "When I die," and he had planned his entire funeral out, "when I die, place them beside me in my grave." And so you can still see them 1,500 years after. Why would Ambrose do that? Because the martyrs, they show us again. They inspire us to see the ways in which our hearts can be changed, softened, directed, and made whole. See, the courage of the martyrs is not about brute discipline. It's not about begrudged resolve. It is about living with the heart of Jesus within your own soul. And isn't that what Lent is all about? Looking to the heart of God made manifest to us in the presence of Jesus Christ the Son, and letting him slowly, with great gentleness and grace, transform our wills, our emotions, our dispositions, so that we might have the law of God, his own goodness, enshrouding our heart. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen.